This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington, catching up with Nathan McCree. It's really great to have a chance to talk again.
Hi, Kate. Yeah, it's good to speak to you as well.
Boy, it's been quite a journey. We talked just after you announced that you were going to create an orchestral version of the original music for the first three Tomb Raider games.
Yeah.
And since then, there's just been so much going on. So it's been a fantastic journey. And all of us who love Tomb Raider and love your music are just so excited that you're not really in the home stretch, but you've certainly got some news about the soundtrack being available now for the Tomb Raider suite.
Yeah, so, the Kickstarter was successfully funded, which was great. Went into Abbey Road, got it recorded, mixed and mastered there. And then we spent a while setting up the digital download distribution network. So, yeah, that took us a while to just research that a little bit. Basically, Kate, I've had to learn how to be a record company. And, you know, that's no small feat. You know, there's been an extraordinary amount of bureaucracy to get through, form filling, registering the music worldwide. You know, it's been a long, long process. But now the digital download is available on all digital outlets and streaming platforms. So, yeah, we're over the first major hurdle.
That is so fantastic. And as I was one of the Kickstarter backers, and I was so looking forward to this. And what it reminds me of is seeing like your favorite painting from the Renaissance all cleaned up and restored. And it has this its original luster. That's what it's like to hear these pieces performed by an orchestra.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly has brought a fresh bit of life to it for me as well. You know, in particular, one thing that was missing from my compositions back in 1996, which it never even crossed my mind, and I didn't realize this until I was listening to the recordings back again, that, you know, because we made an archive recording of the show at the Apollo, right? And when I listened back to the recordings, I noticed that obviously we were in time to the conductor, but what the conductor was doing was pushing the timing faster and slower and faster and slower, depending on what phrasing was being played. And I never really realized the effect that would have on a piece of music, you know, these fluctuations in the timing. And that fascinated me. So I studied what he'd done, and I mapped out the tempos to those recordings made at the Apollo. And yeah, learned a little bit, I guess, about how timing can really be used to sort of, you know, push an emotion forward or hold it back. You know, it made a huge difference to the music. So yeah, I'm really grateful for his input there, and learning a lot as we go.
That's so interesting, because normally in a game, when the music is implemented, it has to exactly match the character's footsteps or the action or whatever. But now that they're concert pieces, that must be one of the reasons why they sound so much richer and like really complete pieces, each one with its own little story arc. And I know you had to really work hard to make them sound like that, because some of these themes originally were only like 20 seconds. Yeah. So it must have been a lot of fun to have an opportunity to go back and extend them.
Yeah, you know, I was a little bit concerned when we first set out on the project. I was a bit worried that I might not be motivated to, you know, write or to revisit this material again, because, you know, 20 years later, you know, I do things quite differently now. So when I went back to this material, I was just thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to be thinking, oh, what a load of rubbish. You know, why did I do that? I can do it so much better now. But to my surprise, I actually quite enjoyed listening to them again. And because I was extending the pieces out from, you know, like half a minute out to 3 minutes, there was actually quite a lot of new material to write. So that in itself gave me all the motivation I needed. And I spent 3 months in the studio writing away, thoroughly enjoying it. So yeah, I was pleasantly surprised.
That's fantastic. And that's quite a difference from the 3 weeks you had writing the music for the original Tomb Raider.
Well, you know, with Tomb Raider, there's about 25 minutes of in-game music, and I spent 3 weeks writing that. But it was a real rush, you know, to get that stuff done. Similar amount of music in Tomb Raider 2 and 3. So when it came to writing the suite, I was looking at making about 90 minutes of music, and that took 3 months. So I was spending a little bit longer on each tune, probably about between 2 and 3 days on each tune, and writing about 2 minutes worth of new material in that time for each track. So yeah, I was going a little bit slower than I did with the original games, but you know, it was my project now, and it was up to me, you know, when things were going to be ready. So yeah, I took my time a little bit more and made sure I got it right.
Thank you. I remember when we talked the first time, you mentioned that having a deadline is actually a real a good thing, because it forces you to keep your music simple and not like keep faffing around with it and adding extra stuff and making it complicated. And so since you had this luxury of extra time, did you actually do that, make things a little bit more complicated or a little bit more demanding?
Well, you know, when I say, I had a little bit more time, I was still on the deadline, you know, and it was still, you know, I was still going, pretty quickly. And my main concern was not to overcomplicate it, because I didn't want suddenly, you know, you've got music from 20 years ago, and then in the next bar, you've got music from 20 years later. You know, I didn't want it to be a real contrast. I wanted the new music that I was writing to sound like I'd written it 20 years ago. So sometimes I'd be writing some new stuff and I'd think, no, that's too much. That's too complicated. I wouldn't have done that 20 years ago. So I started stripping stuff out again. And it was that sort of approach that I was paying particular care and attention to, was trying to make sure that I was writing in the same style as I did 20 years ago. So although I had a little bit more time, there was 24 tracks to write in 3 months. And yeah, you know.
That's still a lot.
Yeah, the deadline was still there. You know, we had to have it ready for the show. You know, this was the thing. We had to have it, I had to have it ready by the end of the summer to then give it to the orchestrator. And he had, I think, 2 months to do the orchestrations before it had to go to print. And then literally a week later, we were playing it live. So I think the orchestra actually only saw the parts for about 7 days.
Wow. Well, they're pros, so they can they can totally handle it. But yeah, let's talk about how you work with Adam Langston, because his orchestrations are incredible. That he absolutely kept that sound from those synths that you used 20 years ago with real instruments. And so how closely did you work with him?
Well, it was our first conversation, I remember, with Adam. I was talking to him on Skype, and I was very specific about him replicating the sound that I'd made. I gave him the synth mixes from my studio and all the MIDI parts, and I said, look, this is what it sounds like. I want you to just translate this into the live orchestra, into a score. So I said, you know, I don't want you to do any embellishments or, you know, decorate it or add this or add little flurries. I said, I just want you to literally translate it. You know, when I'm working on synths, I might have a sound that's like, I don't know, brass pad or synth pad or woodwind pad. Okay. And then what Adam does is he listens to that texture and goes, aha, well, to make that sound, we'll need 2 bassoons, 2 clarinets, a flute, and an oboe playing these notes. Okay. And then when they all play together, it sounds like my woodwind pad. that's his skill set. That's something which I can't do because I don't know the orchestra as well as he does. I don't know how those instruments work together to make the sound that's on my synthesizer, you see. So that's why I needed him. But I didn't want somebody to come along and turn it into a Hollywood film score. That's definitely not what I wanted. So I was very specific about that. And he's brilliant at his job. And he did. He translated my sound almost exactly.
It really is. And you can really hear it in the T-Rex cue.
Yeah.
it's so much fun to hear the live orchestra with, you know, the marimba and the tension and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. I mean, I had a massive smile on my face at the Apollo when I listened to it. I was just like, wow, you know, he just did a fantastic job.
It's great. Well, I watched one of the videos of kind of the pregame show, let's call it, for one of the recording sessions at Abbey Road. And it was so interesting to hear the orchestra warming up and hear them, you know, playing just little fragments, little bits of these themes. And if it was that cool for me, it must have been amazing for you to hear the concert, that first concert at the Hammersmith.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to describe how it makes you feel. There's a lot of relief because, you know, it's been such a long time and such a long journey getting everything ready. So when you do finally hear it, you know, I was quite nervous about, you know, is it going to sound like what I wanted, you know, or is it going to sound different? Are they going to play it right? Are they going to find it difficult? You know, all that sort of thing. So, yeah, big sense of relief when they first started playing. I wasn't too happy with what they were doing in the rehearsals, but I was told, you know, don't worry about it. They'll get it right on the night. And they did. So it was all good.
Wow. Well, not only did you have yourself to please, but you also have the millions of fans who've been waiting for this and who've been playing Tomb Raider for the last 20 years. But it sounds like, from what I've seen on Twitter and Facebook and the Kickstarter, that everybody is just so happy with how it came out. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I'm really pleased about that. There's been a couple of people that have been critical of certain things. One guy has spotted a little timing mistake, another guy something else, but you know, that's fair enough. Yeah, there are little mistakes and little hiccups in there, but you know, you would expect that when you're recording 120 people simultaneously.
Well, yeah, let's talk about those recording sessions, because you were able to use the Royal Philharmonic, which is just, you know, five-star orchestra. They're phenomenal.
Yeah.
And Metro Voices, and Robert Ziegler was the conductor.
Yep.
The recording sessions were incredibly, there were five of them, five three-hour sessions over 2 days. Is that typical?
I don't know whether that's typical or not. I mean, you know, we're governed by musicians' unions regulations, so we're not allowed to record more than a certain amount of music per session. We're not allowed to do more than three sessions a day. We're not allowed to keep people on overtime unless we pay them, and all sorts of conditions which we have to adhere to. I think it's pretty normal when you're recording a big orchestral setup like that to have at least two sessions a day. We did three because it was certainly, we did three in our, I think it was the first day. The first day we did three sessions. Yeah, because originally we'd planned for four sessions, but I convinced my business partner. I said, look, I think we should do five sessions, you know, and I spoke to Robert Ziegler, the conductor, as well. And I said, what do you think? Do you think we can get this music done inside four sessions? He said, I wouldn't risk that. He said, I'd do five sessions because, you know, even though they're a great orchestra, they do need to practice and things do go wrong and you do have problems that you need to fix on the day. So I booked the extra session and yeah, boy, did we need it. We really did. we were going right up to the last second. Literally, we were watching the seconds tick down on the last track. And when it hit the hour, Ian McClay, the orchestra manager, he came and he said, right, guys, that's enough. We have to stop. Fortunately, we'd got everything we wanted to get. So, yeah, it was good.
Ah, that's fantastic. Were there any surprises, like with the balance or the mix or things that didn't quite work with the orchestration on the first go?
It's not so much whether they work with the orchestrations or not. It was really down to physically recording things so that we would have as many options available to us in the mixing session as possible. So although we wanted to record 120 people simultaneously, there were moments where that was causing us problems. The brass weren't quite as tight rhythmically when they were playing with the full orchestra. So on some of the tracks, we recorded the strings and the woodwind in one take, and then we recorded the brass separately, and then we recorded the percussion after that. But we only did that on two or three tracks where the rhythm was very fast and we had everybody playing. So to give us more flexibility in the mixing sessions, we recorded sections of the orchestra separately, just to give us, you know, a little bit more room. Thank you. it was still, you know, the mixing session was probably the most difficult part, because that's where we join everything together and remove any errors that, you know, people have made during the recording by swapping them out for a different take and this sort of thing. And so there was a lot of editing that had to be done. And when you're editing over 100 different tracks simultaneously, that was beyond me. So I was very grateful to have Paul Pritchard do all the Pro Tools work on that. I mean, he was a brilliant engineer.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to ask you what the mastering process was like, because, again, you know, you had a lot of material to go through. So what did you do to kind of keep your ears from getting tired and getting your brain from getting tired?
Yeah, I mean, that was a problem, certainly in the mixing session, because our first mixing session was 6 days. And, you know, we've got 24 tracks to mix. So if you divide that up into 6 days, you know, you're talking 3 tracks a day minimum. So, you know, you're going really quick, because you got 1 hour to sort of set up the track, you know, another hour or two making all the edits, and then you've got 1 hour left to finalize it. So you're really going. There isn't time to, you know, to have a cigarette break, really. I mean, it's just crazy. And so after like 3 or 4 days of that, yeah, it is tiring. Your ears do get tired, and you start picking at things unreasonably because your ears aren't hearing properly. So what we did, and we knew about this, so what we did was we had the initial 6 day mixing session, and then we had a break for 2 weeks. And during those 2 weeks, myself and David, my business partner, and Paul, the engineer, during those 2 weeks, we had a little break. And then we started listening to them again and making notes individually on things that we wanted to change. And then we went back to Abbey Road for a 2 day pickup mixing session, where we collated all our thoughts and then went through them literally one by one on a spreadsheet, going, okay, fix that note, fix this, this needs turning down, this needs turning up, bang, 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 bang. We went through all of that in the 2 days, and then we had our album, which sounded great. So,
and it does.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it is important about ear fatigue. Like I say, you basically, the first thing to go is the top end frequencies. They start sounding dull. And so what happens is you start turning up the top end frequencies to compensate for your ears. But then, of course, you're making the mix too bright. So this is why it's important to have a rest, let your ears reset, and then come back to the music for a second session.
That's a brilliant plan to take care of that. And in addition to all of the tracks that we expected, like the incredible Indians, there's something spooky in that jungle. You wrote 2 new pieces,
yeah,
especially for the project. In the Blood is just, it's beautiful, because it's like hearing an old friend talk, and yet it's new. So what was your inspiration for that one?
So there were 2 new pieces. It was Precious Moments and In the Blood. Well, what was my inspiration? You know, I mean, by this point, I'd been writing the Tomb Raider Suite. So I've been writing all the new material for at least, I don't know, 2.5 months. So I was firmly in the Tomb Raider zone. Precious Moments was, I guess it kind of came from Time to Run, although it doesn't sound anything like Time to Run. But it's basically a piece designed to be used when time is running out, and hence the title Precious Moments, because there's not much time left, kind of thing. So it's a bit like a sort of, the clock's running out, it all starts, you know, pretty calmly, but then accelerates and gets quite agitated towards the end. was a similar structure with In the Blood. You know, I quite enjoyed Precious Moments, so I thought, well, why don't I just do another one similar to that? But in a, you know, I guess using slightly different harmonies and structure. You know, my inspiration just comes from my imagination. You know, I imagine what Lara might be doing, and then I describe that musically. You know, a good example of that is A Friend Since Gone. You know, originally when I wrote that, there wasn't a place in the game that I was writing that for. I just thought, well, Lara loses her guide at the beginning of the game, and maybe there'll be a point in the game where she might have some time for reflection. So why don't I write a piece of music about her thinking about her friend, her mountain guide, who she lost, you know, in the wolf attack. I thought, well, mate, I'll write something about that. Maybe she can be feeling sad about him and stuff, and, you know, sorry for the friend that she's lost. So I wrote that piece of music. And then after I'd written it, I thought, right, let's try and find somewhere in the game where this will work. So Precious Moments and In the Blood was done in a similar vein. I just imagined some stuff that Lara might be doing and then, you know, wrote some music that I think thought would fit that.
Yeah, and there's plenty of stuff she could have been doing, exploring, we're figuring out a puzzle. And I love the medleys, too, that you put together for each of the three games, because it's like all the best stuff just right in a nutshell. And the transitions are just fantastic, especially in the Tomb Raider 1 medley, where it just morphs right into the T-Rex music. It's really great.
Yeah, you know, it's good fun doing all that kind of stuff. It's quite a challenge because sometimes you're moving from one piece to another that has a completely different tempo, or it's in a completely different key. And sometimes it's in a key that's unrelated to the key before. And so it's like, how am I gonna transition this? How am I gonna get from this chord to that chord in a nice way? So yeah, there's a lot of experimentation and discovery and trying to find those little bridging sections, but very enjoyable to do stuff like that. We'll be right back.
Well, we're not even at the end of the project yet, because there is a documentary that's in progress.
Yeah.
So what's the status on that now?
So I've just seen trailer excerpt from the documentary, which we're going to be putting in front of various TV distributors and other TV stations to see if we can, you know, get some sales from that. So I've seen the excerpt. I'm very pleased with it. It looks great. Sounds great. And hopefully we're going to be posting that on social media pretty soon, so people can have a little taste of what's to come. In terms of where we are exactly with that, we've got about 2 months editing in front of us. Yeah, I think at that point it'll be ready. We've got our director, Matthew Longfellow, who's going to be coming in on it in the next, well, I'm not sure, days or weeks, but he's certainly coming in to do his first bit of work on that. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to meeting him, because he's a bit of a legend in his own right.
Yeah, definitely. And then there are still some live concerts sort of in the works, or at least discussions are in progress for those as well, right?
Yeah. You know, I always wanted to take the show, you know, around the world, and that's still my mission. I never expected it to happen straight away, so it's a case of just chipping away at it bit by bit. You know, we've done 2 shows in London now. We've got 2 coming up in Australia, 1 in Melbourne and 1 in Sydney. We're talking to people in Venice, Tenerife, France, Germany. Our promoter in Australia wants to take it out to Singapore, South Korea, China and Japan. So the sort of Far East side of things, it seems to be moving faster than the West. We had some talks with people in America, but that's kind of, we got a bit stuck with that. So we're looking at some new avenues there. But yeah, you know, it's a long journey that, but yeah, bit by bit, I think we're starting to make some noise. And, you know, each show helps get the next one. You know,
oh, sure.
You know, it's a big snowball thing. So, you know, we just have to keep pushing it. And hopefully, you know, there's lots of things that we can do on social media as well. You know, I want to try and get people to, you know, set up some kind of poll or vote or something. So if people shout loud enough about a particular city that they wanted to go to, then that will help us go to that place, because we can see from our polls, you know, where the highest interest lies. You know, there's no point in taking the show to Madagascar. There's only one person there, for instance. So, you know, it's sort of doing a bit of that, a bit of fact finding and a bit of, you know, well, a lot more talking to, you know, people that put on these things, because they're expensive to do. They cost anything between sort of £60,000-£70,000 and £100,000 each show.
Wow. Yeah. Well, how can people keep up with news about what's going on still with the suite and the project?
There's our website, which is primarily our shop, but also we have, you know, information pages on there about the live show. And what I'm doing is I'm posting venues and the dates of those venues and a link to where you can get tickets from. I'm posting that on the website, so you'll see new shows coming in on that table as and when they do. Failing that, you can keep in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. Although for information, probably Facebook and Twitter, I would say, are the best for those. Yeah, that's probably the best places to get the information from.
Is there anything that I didn't touch on that you wanted to mention?
Well, so the digital download is out. The CDs are coming. I think they'll be with us in about 2 weeks, something like that. We're making our first shipment of merchandise, certainly to our Kickstarter backers, in under 2 weeks now. I think on the 8th and 9th of December, I'm flying into England and I'm meeting up with David, and we're going to package 2,600 parcels up and send them all out. So people will be getting some nice Christmas presents from Tomb Raider Suite this year. The vinyls will take a little bit longer, and the tin CDs a little bit longer as well. So they're likely to be early next year. But everything else, everything from the Kickstarter campaign, apart from those 2 items, will be shipped out in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Oh, and there will be much rejoicing, I'm sure.
I hope so.
Will everything be available on the store for the non-Kickstarter backers too?
Some of it, not all of it. Some things we've kept exclusive to Kickstarter backers only, particularly the album covers that the Kickstarter people pledged for. We have classic Lara on one and a modern Lara on another. So those two are Kickstarter backers only, exclusive. We've made another album cover for retail sales. The T-shirts from the Kickstarter, you can get those on the website. The 3D logo, you can get that as well. And the souvenir posters, score page, you can get all of that stuff from the website, but that's not signed. So again, the exclusivity for the Kickstarter backers is that I've signed everything.
Wow. That must have been a big project too.
Yeah. I spent 6 hours in London and I did, I think it was 1,400 signatures that day.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, Nathan, first of all, congratulations. This, I know, has been a huge, huge project and a labor of love and a goal of yours for like 20 years. And it's just phenomenal to finally have a chance to hear it. And thank you so much for taking some time to talk about it.
Hey, you're welcome. No, it's been good. You know, we've been saying we should have a catch up for a while. So it's been good to finally get that done as well.